What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Matt Taibbi. I'm excited, I guess, to be reconnecting with the world a little bit. Are you getting used to being in quarantine?
No, it's kind of starting to hit me now how weird it is. And I kind of feel like it's strange that more people aren't freaking out. Because it feels like that movie, The Purge, a little bit. One of them, I'm not sure which ones or which one. But yeah, it's weird. And it feels much more dystopian than anything else I've ever experienced.
It does have a dystopian feel. I do think there's going to be lots of folks who are inching closer to that tri-state killing spree that's in all of us.
Yeah.
Or most of us.
Yeah. Mine's actually quatra-state.
Quatra-state?
Yeah. I'm a bit more of a, I'm a kind of a high achiever.
In a larger sense, look, I'm settling into the routine of, locking myself in a house and just single-mindedly thinking about the biggest news story in the world, which is the NFL draft, obviously coming next week.
Yeah, I'm so glad we get to process that together.
Yeah, so I'm not going to quiz you on the draft this week because next week is the big one.
Right.
So a lot of stuff going on with the coronavirus, with politics, and we got a really interesting guest, an old friend of mine who's a comedian, a cartoonist, a podcaster.
A pencil sharpener.
Yes, and you might notice that I actually have a David Reese pencil on my wall here.
Wow.
A certificate of sharpening. Hang on.
Wow. Whoa.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so David Reese is one of the few people, he's one of the most talented people I know, very funny guy in a lot of realms, and he's got a podcast that's very apropos to what we talk about in this show. It's an election gambling site,
right?
Called Election Profit Makers. We're going to talk to him about the race and his thoughts on that, and he has an interesting take that I actually share that we're going to get into. So, but let's start with the news. Four food groups: Republicans suck, Democrats suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that horrible? Four main categories of news. And we're starting with Democrats suck, which is me this week, right, Katie?
Yeah, that is correct.
A lot of stuff always with Democrats suck, but I'm gonna pick one a little close to home, and I'm gonna go start with a little shot at our own Rolling Stone for its Andrew Cuomo cover. Dan, do we have that graphic?
Bit of an Italian minstrel thing going on.
Like, seriously, we really have to do this, Rolling Stone? I mean, like, what's next? Lloyd Blankfein doing God's work, you know?
Right.
I mean,
how would that look? What would that look like?
Yeah, it would be, I think you'd have Lloyd little backlit.
Right. Looking down at the world or something?
Yeah, exactly. Or with the Atlas.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Lloyd as Atlas would be a good one. I mean, come on. Andrew Cuomo is just one of the biggest douchewads in politics, a complete jackass, and we got to put him on the cover.
You should quit. You should very dramatically quit.
Yeah. No, I don't think that's necessary. But
can you get him to come on the show now? Can you be like, hi, we're just doing a follow up to that photo shoot we did with you?
I'd be afraid to ask that fucking crazy family. And this is a good segue into the next part of my Democrats suck portion. I mean, who knows what you might ask politely, would you like to come on the podcast? And, I'll end up being choked to death or something like that. As we now know, because Chris Cuomo got in yet another incident, the other brother.
He fraided out.
Yeah, who fraided out. And I think we can inject here post factum the Fredo video, just a piece of it, so people don't remember what happened there. But Chris Cuomo, the lesser brother, the guy who's on CNN, he got in another incident where a 65-year-old, a longtime resident of, I guess it was Southampton, was riding by the property where Chris Cuomo apparently lives, and he saw Cuomo congregating with, I guess, his wife and three children, or three people. I mean, he wasn't exactly sure who it was. And the guy asked, Cuomo what he was doing, since he's supposed to be quarantining.
Corona positive, right?
He's corona positive. And the quote from the story in the New York Post, according to this fellow calls himself David, is he said, "Who the hell are you? I can do what I want." And the quote was, he ranted, screaming, "I'll find out who you are." And the guy said to him, "Your brother is the coronavirus czar. You're not even following his rules." And he just began to boil more. He said, "This is not the end of this. You'll deal with this later. We will meet again. If that's not a threat, I don't know what is." That's the report in the New York Post. And I wouldn't necessarily give credence to the story, except Cuomo kind of sort of confirmed it in an interview that he gave. About where, among other things, he sort of complained about the difficulties of the life he leads and the spiritual emptiness of it. And he spoke about this incident. Dan, if we could hear that audio.
"I don't want some jackass, loser, fat tire biker to be able to pull over and get in my face and in my space and talk bullshit to me. I don't want to hear it. That matters to me more than making millions of dollars a year."
So, in other words, making millions of dollars a year, it's just not worth it in the end if you can't tell a fat tire loser on a bike to go to hell. It just spoils it for him.
Yeah.
If he has to suffer through that.
I'll take a million less. Maybe I'll give up a million.
Yeah, like... in the scheme of things, it just doesn't make it worth it anymore if he has to go through scenes like that. Like if he has to listen to people telling him to quarantine himself after he's announced to the world that he's corona positive.
If he has to listen to people imploring him to follow best practices, public health best practices, then is it really living at all? Is it a really, is it even a life?
Yeah, right. This is like one of those philosophy 101 questions,
yeah, exactly, right?
Like,
right.
You know, it's like Plato's cave. Does life have any meaning if you're making millions of dollars, but you have to answer to a fat tire loser on a bike?
I wonder if you could get like a euthanasia based on that. Like, do you think you could apply for euthanasia being like, "I just can't go on. I can't go on anymore. It's too painful."
Yeah, the psychic agony of it is just too much that I had to restrain myself. I had to limit myself to subtly threatening comments, or I guess not so subtly.
Do you think he's playing hooky? Is that why? Like, you think he doesn't actually have it, and he was busted playing hooky?
No, I think he probably does have it, but and you know, like I wouldn't stop on the side of the road and tell the guy to not quarantine. I mean, that's not what I would do. But
what would you do?
I would just ignore it and keep riding a bicycle. So
I'd hose him down. I'd hose him.
You'd hose him down.
Yeah.
Just the whole Cuomo thing, and we're going to get into this a little bit with David because Cuomo is. Look, we might be end up talking about the Cuomos a lot more as this year goes on. But the whole family just sucks so royally. Like, you know, Andrew Cuomo, they're slashing Medicare in the middle of all this, you know, in order to quote unquote strengthen the program.
Yeah.
He's like everything you can't stand about modern Democrats. And then his brother is like a road rage case, but like on foot, you know, he's crazy.
Did you see the thing where he and we should cut some of these in, he and Andrew are have these really weird passive aggressive family disputes about how they should be calling their mom and which one's their favorite? Which one's her favorite?
No, I haven't. I'm not hip to all that. I'm just not ready for this to be part of my life on a daily basis. Or maybe I am. So
I like the way Chris, though. He's very honest in some weird ways. And you can see he's not the brighter. He's the duller Cuomo, if you will. And you can see the gears turning in his brain. Like, you actually can see it from the way his eyes look. It's like the slots or something that you see them moving. And he'll be like Mehdi Hasan was on talking about Bernie and Chris Cuomo brought up the Bernie bros. Mehdi Hasan was like, "Don't you think it's selective? They're abusive, toxic people who support all candidates." And Chris Cuomo was like, "You are so right." Like, he had never thought of that before. And then once he said it, he totally like was receptive to it. It was kind of beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think this is I wouldn't say he's a person who has like his intellectual machinery has a lot of parts to it. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
And Andrew Cuomo, I want to give him a shout out for being so intersectional. I don't know if you remember this. He once said, "I'm a New Yorker. I'm black. I'm gay. I'm Jewish." Did you ever see this? We're going to have to cut this into. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. He identifies as a lot of things. Yeah.
Well, okay. Enough about that. Let's not be petty about Democrats. What do we have when Republicans suck?
So for Republicans suck, we have all seven Supreme Court justices voted absentee, even those who hadn't in the past in Wisconsin. So we talked about this a little last week. This is a common theme is Democrats suck, Republicans suck. What's the difference at the end of the day? So last week, there was the governor of Wisconsin tried to order a delay to the April 7th elections, and the Supreme Court of Wisconsin turned it down. And all seven justices, by the way, had already voted absentee, either by going in early and voting in person or mailing in ballots. And so the irony is that that doesn't usually happen. And in the previous five elections, a majority of the justices vote in person at the polls on election day. But what's so sick about this is that the state Supreme Court voted 4-2 to block the order to postpone the election over concerns about the coronavirus. And of course, not surprisingly, the conservatives voted to oppose the postponement, and the two liberals voted to uphold it. So it's a real case of, you know, like, not living by your own rules, right? So they didn't want to postpone the primary for the people, but they didn't vote themselves. And so what you had is, as we saw, and I think we talked about this last week, you saw people waiting online for hours in the rain. And we'll have to see soon, like, how many people get corona from that. We already had two poll workers test positive from Broward County in Florida, another place where they would not postpone the elections. So it's just kind of a display of the hypocrisy that's always there, but this just happened to kind of present it in a particularly obvious way.
Yeah, I mean, just once, I'd like to see somebody who doesn't have a self-interest in the outcome of a decision on whether or not to hold an election to actually vote in the other way, you know?
Right.
It just, it's been so depressingly consistent along those lines. That was a bad one, though, for sure. I mean, in the middle of this crazy situation, to actually try to hold that election, I don't know what would be worse, I guess. I mean, you would be trying to hold a outdoor football game or something. Like, what would be more ridiculous than
wrestling, actually, which I was torn between this and another Republican suck, which was the governor of Florida declaring WWE. Mm-hmm. Declaring wrestling an essential job. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that, but I totally support that.
So. Yeah, I know.
So, okay, what's next is, isn't that weird, right?
Yeah.
And so it's become part of a problem in the show is that I keep inverting this. All my weirds are horrible and all my horribles are weird. So my weird this week is just horrible. I have a habit in how I consume the news, which is that I regularly just insert the word cannibalism in my Google News searches just because I'm curious to see what cannibal stories come up. I have another friend who used to put comma self in his news searches because he was looking for homicides where people killed others, comma self.
Oh, right.
Right? Because there's always some of those in America.
So that's a suicide homicide?
Yeah, like, you know, man kills dog, comma, nuns, comma, self, you know, right. Like there's always like that story out there somewhere. He used to collect the headlines and pay back when people actually read newspapers. But I punched in cannibalism for this week, figuring that there might be like a rise in it because of coronavirus for some reason. And what we get is cannibal rats.
Disgusting.
Yeah, and this is in New York, and Dan, let's go to the videotape.
Oh no, I don't want to see it. Does it actually show rats?
Yeah, oh yeah.
No.
You want to see it and you want to listen to it.
No. Oh my God, do they make squeaky noises?
When you're savage in New York, you eat your own kind. You're next, buddy. Boy just don't care.
That's the grossest thing. I like peek through. I can't even.
Yeah, like, I love the New Yorkers. It's like the jerky boys in the back of, yeah, where they're like, this is New York, buddy. Is this a disease or homeboy just don't care? So apparently this is happening. We're starting to see rats eating each other. And apparently this is linked to coronavirus, because what's happening is restaurants are closing. Rats apparently aren't able to eat the food that would normally be they'd be getting either in the kitchens of restaurants or outside restaurants, whatever. So they're turning to eat each other. And we saw a quote from in an NBC News story. It's like we've seen, just like we've seen in the history of mankind, when people try to take over lands and fight to the death, literally, for who's going to conquer that land. A new army of rats comes in, and whichever army has the strongest rats is going to conquer that area. When you're really, really hungry, you're not going to act the same. You're going to act very bad, usually.
Not, they're not the polite rats that we're used to seeing around.
Right. These aren't the civilized rats that we, you know, that we usually see, the sort of dog-sized polite rats that we see in the New York subways.
Yeah.
These are different, hungry to the point of eating each other rats that are now all out in society. And you know, I think if you've read Camus, The Plague by Camus, obviously rats and their behavior is a precursor to what goes on with humans
right.
later in the cycle of the disease.
They're like the rats in the coal mine, mixed metaphors.
So it's very possible that two weeks from now, we're going to be seeing, you know, millennials eating each other's heads in Williamsburg. We'll see. All right. What do we have for Isn't That Terrible?
For Isn't That Terrible, we have Israeli settlers flooding sewage into farming lands near Hebron. So illegal Jewish settlers flooded sewage into Palestinian-owned farms planted with grapes near the town of Beit Umar, north of Hebron, in the south of the West Bank, said a local source. So that's pretty cool. I mean, they're basically shitting on Palestinian grapes.
Israelis are.
Yeah. So according to local Palestinian media activist Mohammed Awad, for the second time in a week, several armed settlers from the nearby illegal colonial settlement of Gush Elzeyan flooded grape farmlands with large quantities of wastewater, causing grape trees to flood, causing damage. It's really gross, and they were armed, and they're violating international law, and they've done this before, and it causes financial damage. Also, we've seen them do this with olive trees in the past, and now they're doing it with grapes, which I guess is like a...
So they're pouring sewage onto grapes.
Yeah. If that's not a metaphor for how Israeli settlers in particular are treating Palestinians, shitting on their crops, on their very delectable, tasty... Yeah, wow. They're literally shitting on something that is healthy and good tasting and sweet.
Well, that's terrible. I think we can agree that that's terrible. All right. Well, that's there's the four food groups. There's a lot of interesting stuff this week.
Yeah. Brought us all over the
grapes,
world.
Grapes, rats, Cuomos. Lots to get to in terms of things we want to talk about happening in the world. And let's start with a story that I'm sure was heartwarming for you, which was the endorsement of Joe Biden by Bernie Sanders. Can we go to the videotape?
This is triggering no matter what your politics are.
With that in mind, I'd like to welcome to this conversation a leader who shares those values and has been an outspoken advocate for that vision for a long time. My friend, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome.
Joe, thank you very much for your remarks, and thank you for welcoming me to your live stream here. As you've indicated, we are living in an unbelievably unprecedented moment. You and I were chatting a few months ago, not in a million years would we have believed that we would be talking to each other in our respective homes.
Talking.
That we could not, you know, do rallies, that we could not get out of the house. We would not have believed that we'd be looking not only at a pandemic, which, as you indicated, has taken over 20,000 lives in our country.
Jesus Christ.
Half a million people infected, but has cost us.
Look at Biden. It looks like he's learning this for the first time.
And that's probably a conservative number.
He's straining.
The real number is probably
higher. Who is this again?
Than that. So we are in a terrible moment, an unprecedented moment. And I know we share the understanding that we've got to go forward right now and out of this in an unprecedented way to address the terrible pain that so many of our fellow Americans are feeling. So today I am asking all Americans, I'm asking every Democrat, I'm asking every independent, I'm asking a lot of Republicans to come together in this campaign to support your candidacy, which I endorse,
to
make certain that we defeat somebody who I believe, and I'm speaking just for myself now, is the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country.
So what was your reaction to this?
I didn't even watch it. I saw it happening and I didn't watch it. It was so soon. I think people thought he was going to hold out longer. I mean, first it was Bernie suspending. Then it was, I mean, I thought that he'd try to get more concessions. He had promised that he'd go to the convention, which, okay, I get it. But I like when he endorsed him. I like the way Biden went, oh, it was almost like a quelling Jewish mother moved to tears as if he didn't know that was coming. But it also, it kind of, to me, that sounded, what I heard was my own, oh, like, oh my God, that's awful. Not, oh my God, I'm verklempt, but oh my God, that's terrible. And yeah, I don't know why he did this early. I mean, I guess I do know why, because Barack Obama, who is so sinister because he seems so cool and likable, but we now know that he intervened, right? Just as he did with the Keith Ellison, Tom Perez, Skeletor, when he anointed Skeletor, basically.
Did you feel betrayed at all when you saw that image?
Yeah, I felt betrayed. I mean, I guess he didn't want to be called the spoiler that he was called last time, even though he stayed in and then endorsed Hillary Clinton and campaigned harder for her than she campaigned for herself by going to states that she didn't go to, for instance. Then this myth that he somehow hurt her campaign when he pushed her and the Dems to make them more electable, like, it just never ends. I don't know what Obama told him, and I don't know what deals were made behind the scenes, but people were really upset because it really was so early. I think he made a mistake, Bernie. And, you know, I don't say that a lot, although I kind of was mad at him last week, too. But I do think this was a strategic mistake. First of all, I think it's a mistake to... I think Bernie thinks he's being a team player. I don't think he is, though, ironically, because I really think that as much as his enemies call him an egomaniac, Sanders really isn't.
I think that whole scene was just totally disillusioning for me. Having followed Bernie for a long time and having briefly believed that he was on the cusp of doing something that was going to be transformational and maybe help in sweeping aside this totally dysfunctional and corrupt version of the Democratic Party that we've had for so long. To see him kind of enthusiastically embracing his old buddy Joe that way, I don't know. It was like, I mean, for like a Yankees fan, it would be like watching Derek Jeter in a Red Sox uniform, but
endorsing Darryl
even worse
Strawberry.
Than that, it would be like Derek Jeter in a Red Sox uniform, like rolling around having sex with the Ayatollah or something like that. It was terrible, you know,
unprotected,
unprotected. Yeah, it was deeply upsetting.
Yeah, and why does he like? I think it's like I said this a little bit last week, and I felt a little bad because I'm such a Bernie supporter, and I was a bit hostile towards him last week. I felt like I went through the stages of grief. What is it? It's first is denial.
Denial, anger, blame, depression, acceptance.
So I was in denial the entire time, kind of. Like, you were like, of course it was going to happen. And I didn't think it was going to. I kept thinking the world is in total disarray. I mean, anything could have happened. So there was the denial that I started off with. And then I got angry. I was angry when so I was in denial already. So I just switched immediately to anger when I heard that he was suspending his campaign. And I really am angry about how much I think he likes Joe Biden, how much that clouds his judgment. It's like when a guy likes a girl who's like really taking him for granted and manipulating him, right, and he'll do anything for her. That's kind of what I see, not to play into that very sexist trope, but that's kind of how I see Bernie and Biden. It's like, Bernie, why are you doing this? Biden doesn't even like you that much, or he does, but he's using you. You're such right. Why are you so crushing on Biden?
You can do better than this.
You can do better, and the country can do better. It'd be funny if we gave him a pep talk. Like, no one's going to love you, Bernie, until you learn how to love yourself. And the way to love yourself is by staying in the race and running for president. But it was upsetting. And also, why is Obama, these people are so out of touch and they're so entitled that they don't even know how to hide the optics. Like, they don't even know that they shouldn't make it obvious that Obama did like a backroom deal with them.
Right. Well, and that dates back to, you know, the Super Tuesday situation, right?
Right, right. When he told everyone to drop out, right? When there's moderate consolidation. So Obama, once he got Bernie to take the bullet and endorse Biden first, then he endorsed him because he didn't want to look like he was putting his thumb on the scale. And he obviously did. It's so ridiculous. Okay, so here we go.
I'm so proud to endorse Joe Biden for president of the United States. Choosing Joe to be my vice president was one of the best decisions I ever made. And he became a close friend. And I believe Joe has all the qualities we need in a president right now. He's someone whose own life has taught him how to persevere, how to bounce back when you've been knocked down. Joe has the character and the experience to guide us through one of our darkest times and heal us through a long recovery.
I mean, Barack Obama, I don't know. I don't know what to say about him at this point. I feel kind of betrayed myself, because I really liked him at one point. And during the campaign, I really made an error in judgment in 2008 in thinking that he was something that he really wasn't. But he, you know, he's turned
out to be. Hope he changes stuff.
Yeah, but Sarah Palin said. Even throughout his presidency, I thought he was operating, you know, trying to navigate a series of dynamics as best he could.
Right.
You know, in the for reasons that he probably thought were the right reasons, even though I disagreed with him. Now I think it's pretty clear that legacy, in a personal way, is something that's way more important to him than we probably ever thought.
Yeah,
I think a lot of the issues that he had with Sanders had to do with the implicit rejection of Obama's legacy. That was part of Bernie's candidacy. Candidacy. So I thought that was petty, you know, like Obama ran in some ways. He ran as somebody who was politically a lot closer to Bernie Sanders than he was as president. And then he becomes president and he makes a series of decisions that were really, really regrettable. And I think you could definitely say that Donald Trump's election had a lot to do with things that Obama did. And I personally think the bailouts were a huge factor in that, because independents in particular, and then a lot of Republicans also as well, they were disillusioned, you know, by his treatment of the financial sector, because he won in a lot of places that had a lot of that kind of populist anger towards, you know, the quote unquote elites. And then he comes into office and he does exactly the opposite of what he sounded like on the trail, and that had a huge impact for a lot of people. I mean, he gets into office, and then rather than recognize that you know there were failures in his campaign that had political consequences for his party, he kind of marionettes the situation so that, you know, that critique loses, and you know, his vice president, who he clearly didn't think a whole lot of, you know, while he was in office, and he didn't think enough of to endorse early in the race.
Right.
I don't know. The whole thing is just good look.
I don't even think it's a failure to recognize. I think you're giving him too much moral credit. Like, I think he realizes everything and he's making these strategic choices. And again, we got, you know, who has a new book out, who we have to have on is Thomas Frank. And his book, Listen Liberal, is so eye-opening, because it really makes the point that, like, all these things that we think that Democrats and Republicans disagree over, and that Democrats are, they're just inept, they don't have a spine, they don't know how to fight, it's actually that they want those things. Like, it's not because they don't know how to defend them, it's because they don't want those things, or they do want the deregulation, or they want the banks to do ABC, XYZ. And I really do think it's true. Like, the concerns with legacy, like, I had already, you know, I voted for Obama, and I got excited about him. I never thought he was going to be the real transformational figure that people thought he was. I just thought he was better than Hillary Clinton. And I think on foreign policy, he was, but then he wound up having her as Secretary of State anyway, so it barely mattered. He's a little less hawkish than she is. But in typical moral sellout fashion, or amoral fashion, he gives her the foreign policy. So, like, it barely matters. I mean, I think it was a little bit less hawkish than it would have been if she had been president. But I think, you know what really did disillusion me was when, because I kind of thought he was just a typical sellout, but I did think he had kind of personal honor or something. And when he intervened in the DNC chair election, when Keith Ellison, who was a Bernie Democrat and a part of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, an African-American Muslim, when he ran uncontested to be DNC chair, and Obama basically injected Tom Perez, a charisma-free Department of Labor secretary for Obama, it was so gross. And like, I know that feels weird and so superficial. Who cares? He droned people. He done all these other things. But that really did. I kind of did think he had a decency to him that he clearly didn't, because he went behind the scenes and he had all of his people vote for Tom Perez, who no one had even heard of, who was as charisma free as you can possibly be. Like, he looks like Skeletor, as we've said, but Skeletor has more presence and more charisma. So I think Skeletor would actually be better than Tom Perez. But seeing him do that was really disgusting. Like, I just lost all respect for him in terms of his personal politics and decency, which is so stupid because who cares about that stuff? But he did this again, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's because Bernie, like, Keith Ellison was the Bernie surrogate in that instance. And this time it was Bernie himself. And he didn't want Bernie, who's seen as an alternative to Obamaism, to succeed. And it's gross. And it's petty and it's obvious because it happened like the day after Bernie endorsed him and everyone saw them having their meetings. And, you know, Bernie had said at something last year, he said that the Democrats had a failed business model or something, which is funny. It's like the most capitalist thing that Bernie's ever said. But he said that, and that because Obama was so charismatic, we didn't see it. And then, of course, he got attacked. But he's totally right. Obama is very charming. He has a lot of like low-key swagger. He seems like he's kind of cool to hang out with. But he's dangerous. He really is dangerous in a way that even like Biden isn't, I don't think.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing reminds me of this thing. There's this idea that is common in Russia, which is, you know, for hundreds of years, people used to write to the czar because they believed that whatever, all the corruption they were seeing locally, or the czar's secret police, the Ohrana, if they were torturing people or doing whatever it was or seizing people's property, they would say, oh, if only the czar knew, right? Like because they always believe that the king must be really good inside, and all this stuff that's going on, it's just because he's just not aware, you know. So they would write these long letters, you know, like, no, yes, Libby, if only the czar had some awareness of what was going on in my life. And I think people feel the same way about presidents sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, Obama he was an image for people. He was something to believe in. And, you know, now we're getting the prosaic reality, which is different. And
right.
You know, it's a little depressing. So, yeah, that was quite a scene. Although, you know, you could argue that Bernie is making a strategic decision to try to beat Trump, I get that.
I just think it's wrong, even if he was going to eventually endorse.
But what he's done for the movement that he spent the last however many years trying to build. It's going to be pretty hard to recover.
Yeah, although I do think that the heart of his shtick, the not me, us thing, actually we saw that kind of going to come into effect. I think interestingly enough, as much as people critique his fans for having like a cult of personality or having a Messiah complex, what we've seen is like people are voting for Medicare for All. People are supporting Medicare for All, even if they then vote for Biden. So it's kind of the opposite of what people accuse him of, which is this like, individualistic, leader-obsessed movement. I mean, people are sticking to these issues. And I think right away, people are like, this sucks. A lot of people were angry at Bernie. A lot of people felt conflicted. I felt conflicted. I felt angry at him. But I also am so much angrier at the media and politicians like Obama for their outsized role in all of this. Right. And in their outsized role in not vetting Joe Biden. And I think that they are being totally irresponsible. It's not because I hate Biden's policies, which I do. It's because I think he's just uniquely unelectable. And I think that it is kind of cool, though. I mean, you had Breonna Joy Gray, Bernie's press secretary, tweet, you know, with all due respect for Bernie, like she's not endorsing Joe Biden. So I don't think it's going to set the movement back, ironically, as much as you were fearing, because I think that it almost, it's oddly enough, almost like what Bernie's saying. It's like, it's not him. It's a movement. And now he's not in it. And like, people are going to have to step up. I mean, you could see it as a blow because we don't have the leader that we had before. And that's a whole other conversation. I think there's like this elitist leftist shaming of people who like someone's personality. It's like, you're not going to reinvent the wheel. Like Donald Trump is a charismatic, bad leader. I think Bernie Sanders is a charismatic, good leader. But he left us with some infrastructure in terms.
Yeah, I just, you know, and we've talked about this before. I just think that, you know, the strategy there, you gotta, play your cards a little bit closer to try to get some concessions. Although, to be fair, this is an unusual situation, and he doesn't have a whole lot of leverage left, given this.
But he does kind of, right? Like, isn't the endorsement in itself leverage? Like, if he had held off.
No, of course, yes. But, you know, you could argue that could backfire also. I mean, who knows?
He's got Biden goggles on, you know, drunk goggles. He's got Biden goggles because he's such a crush on Biden. He does.
I just can't watch that. That video is tougher for me to watch than the rats eating each other's heads for you.
Yeah. So I'm going to force you to watch that.
Another thing that I want to get into, and I think this is going to be unpopular with a lot of folks, is the coverage of the COVID disaster and how it's intersecting with coverage of Trump in ways that I'm not so sure are good. Just to take one example is the way that we're reporting on a drug like hydroxychloroquine. And it's gotten so over the top. And let's just take some examples before we get into the issue. I don't know how you feel about this, but I think this is something that's worth talking about. So, for instance, last week, the Ohio State Representative Tavia Galonsky threatened to take Trump to report Trump to The Hague over his hydroxychloroquine referral, suggesting that this is a crime against humanity. And then we had, you know, Mika Brzezinski in this amazing clip where she's having a dialogue with Joe about the hydroxychloroquine thing. And if Dan, if we could look at this videotape.
Why is MSNBC, why is CNN, why is Fox, why is any network running these press conferences where he keeps talking about an unproven drug that might work for malaria, might work for lupus, doesn't work for this?
Dr. Fauci wasn't allowed to talk about what he feels is important to say about this drug that the president keeps pushing. A lot of people would say, follow the money. There's got to be some sort of financial tie to someone somewhere that has the president pushing this repeatedly.
That clip kind of reminds me a lot of the Russiagate stuff, right? Where, let's take fact A and then immediately speculate about thing B that we have absolutely no evidence for, but let's just throw it out there anyway. But the larger point, you know, and I did a little thought experiment earlier this week where I just started calling people in other countries to ask, you know, what's the prevailing view about hydroxychloroquine in France, in England, in Germany, in places like that, in places where Donald Trump is not the prevailing factor in press coverage. And I had one guy who was a molecular biologist in England saying, you know, when he dealt with Americans, it's like, show me a person who has an opinion about Donald Trump and I'll tell you what that person's view on hydroxychloroquine is.
Right.
And this is something that's starting to happen in the media, which is that we're reverse engineering how we think about a whole series of issues. Because if Donald Trump says X, then Y must be true.
Yeah.
Let me make clear, I am not endorsing hydroxychloroquine by any means.
Or Donald Trump.
I just think that this is, you know, in the middle of a situation like this, what ends up happening is that people feel so strongly about the Trump issue that we end up with, you know, all this sort of groupthink that goes on with a series of other issues. And, you know, the science on hydroxychloroquine is mixed. There's some anecdotal evidence. There's a couple of studies in France, one that's like more dubious than the other. One of the main proponents in France is a pretty significant scientist over there. And there are problems with the study. But there are also lots of doctors who are co-signing the study. That doesn't mean that it's proven or that he's being responsible by talking about it, but you see what I'm getting at?
Of course. It's like the Syria thing too. Like whatever he does is bad in it per se. And, or sui generis, is that, what's the Latin thing?
I'm not sure.
Prima facie, whatever. Ex post facto. No, I know it's not that one, but no, it's like, it's actually extremely dangerous. The left cannot be our politics cannot be responding to Trump and doing the exact opposite of what Trump does, because Trump will do some good things, maybe for the wrong reasons, but just statistically, not every single decision he makes is going to be bad. And you don't have to like Trump to notice that. That's what's so frustrating, is that it's like the most powerless, neutered opposition comes from the people who whose entire understanding of opposition is whatever Trump does, we do the opposite of.
Yeah, and it's not like people don't notice the tenor of this kind of coverage, and it just makes it it leaves people less confident in what the press has to say about something at a moment when we desperately need the press to be functioning, you know, specifically on this level of like factuality, like what does this drug work or does it not work, right? Like you can't make hydroxychloroquine a Trump referendum. You have to make it something that you're just, okay, what are the studies? What does it say? Like, you know, who cares what Trump says, you know, about that? And if we end up doing that about the next drugs that are in the pipeline, whether it's hydroxycitidine or whatever the next thing is, you know, that's going to be a problem. If Trump says something about ventilators, you know, like you know, we've already seen with this crisis that there's a problem, which is that groupthink quickly coalesces around, and people are so angry and frustrated about this issue that they get emotional about responding to certain things. But we're finding out already that like a lot of the things that we thought about this disease are wrong. You know, the doctors go back and forth. Do ventilators actually work? You know, like people who are put on ventilators, their outcomes are almost uniformly bad. At one point they thought the disease doesn't actually work that way, so that maybe the ventilators aren't the appropriate treatment. Now they're going, some people are going back to thinking that actually they do work. But you can't get emotional about this. You have to just wait to see how it plays out and cover it how it comes and try as best as possible to divorce it from the politics, because people are just desperate for information more than anything, you know?
Well, it's ironic because they're acting the way that they critique Trump for acting, which is not intellectual, not empirical, kind of, you know, fly by the seat of your pants, shooting from the hip, emotional, irrational thought. And that's what Trump does do a lot. And then they're kind of doing it in a weird way. Of course, I'm still haunted by the way the DNC and Joe Biden's campaign ignored the CDC recommendation, which also puts them in that kind of Trumpian anti-science camp. And, you know, I keep thinking about Russiagate because, and something you said early on, Matt, in our show was that, you know, there were so many ways that you could respond to Trump and the media. Actually, you may have said this on my show before we started doing the show. The media had so many choices of how to respond to Trump, and they responded in the way that totally played into his hand. Mm-hmm. They walked into his trap because he's talked about how fake the media was and how much they kind of had it out for him. And, you know, Trump did some egregious things in terms of not doing certain, like, he failed to do a lot of things when it comes to pandemics, and he like fired people and he didn't listen to warnings and he did do terrible things. Like
or the travel ban. I mean, there's a million things you could point to.
I mean, yeah. But I mean, just for this one, let's just like just sticking on Corona, sure. Like he has done, and we should probably go over this. I have someone on to tell us all the things that he did that were wrong, but that like should have stood out as impeachable or should have stood out as egregious. And it didn't, because the news was constantly talking about Russia and Russiagate, and they are like the boy who cried wolf, and they wasted their wad on that story that was not that morally significant, was not going to bring him down. It was kind of like a self-indulgent tantrum that maybe people thought based on their dinner parties was actually going to bring him down. But had no idea how the rest of the country outside of like their, you know, coastal elites, not to sound like Rush Limbaugh or something, saw it. And right. I'm really angry because it's like what he did earlier with Corona should have been a uniquely criticized thing. Like it should have stood out, and it hasn't, and it didn't, in part because there was so much hysteria around and conspiracy theorizing around.
Well, we were all collectively wasting the time of the entire country with this, with the ridiculous Ukraine-gate situation.
Russia-gate, then Ukraine-gate, right? Yeah.
And you know, nobody talks about that now. And yeah, there are things that Trump is doing, and I think we can get into this with our guests too, in terms of you know, talking about reopening the country on May 1st and how he has the authority to do that. Like some of that stuff is crazy, and I am really worried about that. I really worry about is we're still unable to get out of the financial paradigm of our business is telling people news about Trump that they're not, that they, you know, bad news about Trump, and they're unable to decouple that from how we cover the crisis. And we have to, you know what I mean? Like, we desperately need the information decoupled from all this bullshit. So
you should write something on that, how it's actually a public health risk to be so wedded to automatically rejecting whatever Trump says.
Right. Yeah. We have to not worry about Trump. I mean, there's, you can definitely do the reporting on how, on his response, but like let's
that
look at
what, shouldn't determine our take on something.
Right. And you can also see it in the way that the numbers have been reported, right? Because Trump has an interest in saying that the disease isn't as bad. Right. Or the impact isn't going to be as bad as we thought. And then so what you're seeing on the other side is that there's this glee when, like, for instance, when the United States overtook China for the most deaths, there was almost like this, I told you so,
right.
Tenor to the news coverage. And like, what's that about? Like, are we happy now that we have the most deaths in the world? Like, is that something that we're really
American
proud of?
Exceptionalism?
Right. Yeah. There was all those sarcastic comments about how this is American exceptionalism now. And it reminded me of like, oh, we have to brace ourselves for the bad news that, you know, the Mueller investigation is going to turn out that he's not a Russian spy. Like, right. Like that's bad news, you know?
Right. Exactly.
I don't want to go on too much about this because Trump, there are things about this that are completely nuts but that aspect of it is concerning.
No, and he's psychotic. He's like, I have it in my head. That's where it comes from. It's my head. I just think it. Like, he's insane. And but again, it's like we wind up, you and I are people making these arguments. It's almost like we wind up, it's not like we're protecting Trump. We're just trying to make people oppose him for the right things.
Right, yeah.
And expose what's worth exposing.
Or I mean, I look at it in a different way. I look at it as, let's just not have him be the predominant factor in how we think about the world, because he's not actually as important as we're making him out to be. Like, he is important, but, you know, in terms of trying to figure out how the world's working, we don't need him to be the primary, like, variable in every equation.
Right, you know? And it just helps him, again, it helps him because he's getting all this free media coverage, and that's...
Exactly.
And he doesn't care what we say about him, and his fans don't care what we say about him. He thinks like his fans are going to be like, well, I read this thing in the New York Times that actually he's being irresponsible. So now I'm going to not vote for him.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's just the thing. And it's probably worth keeping an eye on as we look at, you know, the numbers, and it's going to come up again because, you know, we're starting to see changes in how the disease is progressing. Like, the curve is maybe flattening a little bit here and there, and there's going to be some pretty odd media responses. I think we'll probably end up seeing that in the next couple of weeks. And now we're going to have a discussion with a longtime friend of mine, great political cartoonist, podcaster, comedian, David Reese. And let's check it out. All right. So good morning, David Reese. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks for asking. How are you?
I am good.
And really?
Yeah, I am kind of good.
All right.
Yeah,
all things
must be nice.
Right. All things considered. And just to get it out of the way, you and I are old friends, and it turns out you and Katie have met at some mm-hmm. point. So this is not introducing ourselves for the first time. You're in LA now, right? So
no wonder you're not doing so well.
Wow, a little zing
there,
huh?
I'm
right
sorry.
Out of the gate.
Native New Yorker. You know what? I actually like LA despite myself. It's Boston that I can't stand.
I'm glad that even a worldwide pandemic is not enough to make New Yorkers turn up their nose at people in LA.
No, never. Yeah. No, I do like LA, actually.
This kind of institutional stability is what is going to give us a foundational sense of safety and optimism in these troubling times.
And togetherness and unity.
The New York LA wars will not end.
That would be very disorienting. So thank God for small favors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that just oozes sincerity the way you said it like that. Well, we'll get it. David's obviously a man of many talents. I knew him ages ago. Before we even met, obviously he was a cartoonist who was famous for Get Your War On, which was an extremely popular comic during the Bush years. extremely funny. David did the cover for one of my books. We worked together on a couple of projects. He did some very funny comics about Thomas Friedman once upon a time.
Back when Thomas Friedman was the big boogeyman, and it's like
those were quaint times, right?
Yeah, that was the world is flat.
Right, oh, right. Yeah, you did. You did the mustache of understanding.
That's right. Yeah, but we even talked about making a documentary about Thomas Friedman once. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
We were going to go Hollywood with our Thomas Friedman love, and
you still should.
Never happened. Yeah,
I think we were like taking a walk in Beacon, talking about that, right?
Probably, yeah. I used to live in Beacon. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
You could call it Freed Man.
No, it was Washington. We had that discussion in
Washington. Yeah, it was in Washington, D.C. You're right. You were just getting started with the Goldman Sachs stuff.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, we thought there was enough there to make a whole funny documentary out of it. But I guess that was it never happened. And then you got into artisanal pencil sharpening, which I was showing our audiences before. David, I still have this on my wall.
Oh, you put it in a box. That looks terrific.
Right?
Oh, I'm so flattered. Yeah.
Yeah.
And looks good.
So before we get to what you're doing now, can you tell folks a little bit about your pencil sharpening project?
So as Matt mentioned, I was a political cartoonist, and my plan was always to quit when Bush left office. I thought that was going to happen in 2004, and it didn't. So I re-upped for another 4-year tour. And then obviously when Obama won and Bush left office, I filed my last cartoon, I think, on the day of Obama's inauguration, because I knew all problems were solved and there was no reason for political satire. Of course, I quit that career during a recession and had no money. So that summer, or I guess it was 2010, actually, I got a job working for the census just because I needed money. And the first day of census training, you know, as a door knocker, what they call an enumerator, the first thing we did was sharpen our government issued No. 2 pencils. It was not quite as cool as learning how to clean the chamber of your government issued M16 in the jungles of Vietnam, but it was still kind of like this intense interaction with a government issued object that you were going to, a tool that you were going to use. And we had these little handheld pocket sharpeners, the kind of single blade sharpeners that give you kind of like that apple peel ribbon effect that's so evocative and nostalgic. And I was having so much fun sharpening the pencils. I was like, I wonder if I could just get paid to just sharpen pencils. Like, I wasn't really excited about going around town and knocking on doors and getting yelled at by paranoid people about how Obama was going to take their guns or whatever.
And replace them with sharpened pencils.
Yeah, exactly. So I started an artisanal pencil sharpening business, and I sharpened over the years something like 2,500 pencils for customers all over the world. And I got a book deal, and I wrote a book called How to Sharpen Pencils that Matt blurbed. I was kind enough to blurb. And then that led to a TV show that I hosted called Going Deep, which was kind of in the same spirit. It was a how-to show about how to do really simple things really well. So like how to make the perfect ice cube, how to tie your shoes perfectly. Our most controversial episode was called How to Open a Door.
I got to ask about, I think we've had this discussion before, but I remember seeing you do a stand-up performance about where you read off a chapter from How to Sharpen Pencils.
Okay. Remember that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I got the feeling that like there was a sort of a middle zone between where there's joke, irony, and sincerity, that you were kind of lost somewhere in there, that at some point you are actually sincerely fully engaged in trying to document everything conceivable about how to sharpen a pencil correctly, or was it always like an ironically and
it was I guess I would call it a quantum state. It was it started out just as a challenge to myself, like, could I make money sharpening pencils? Like, what, how would I have to brand it, how would I have to market it to get people to pay for it? I was living at the Hudson Valley at the time, which is full of artisanal this and artisanal that.
Yeah, you got that amazing apron.
I had a whole look. I had an apron. I have magnifying goggles, you know, the type of thing that like jewelers and fine workers use. So I called it artisanal pencil sharpening. It was a comment on that culture, and the people who ordered the pencils, I think most of them were not ordering them to actually use them. They were ordering them as like a lot of graduation gifts, or parents would order a lucky pencil for their kid because their kid was about to take the SAT. I did retirement gifts for teachers, a perfectly sharpened pencil. Did some wedding gifts, some engagement gifts, you know, if the people were writers or librarians or something like that. But over the year, you know, over the years, like, you do something enough, you can't help but be interested in like what is the best way to do this thing? So I invested money in all different kinds of pencil sharpeners. And when I got the book deal, I read this incredible book about pencils by a guy named Henry Petrovsky, who's an engineering professor at Duke mm-hmm. University, called The Pencil, A History of Design and Circumstance. I think that's what it's called. And it's basically like a 400-page history of the pencil as a feat of engineering, as an incredibly simple and portable and elegant and effective writing tool, you know? And I toured a pencil factory, one of the last American pencil factories in New Jersey, General Pencil. Shout out to General Pencil Company. Toured the factory. It was like, it's Jersey City, I think. I'd have to check. I can't remember.
Not Patterson or something?
I'll look it up. But it's in a big brick building with a sign painted on the side that says General Pencil Company. And if you were driving by, you'd be like, oh, that's so cool. They turned an old pencil factory into high-end condominiums for millionaires who work downtown in Manhattan. But no, it was like still a pencil factory. Like, they were still doing it. They made the graphite in the basement. And then it was like, as you worked your way up the floors of the factory, you got to the top where they were painting the pencils and attaching the ferrule, the little metal band that connects the pencil to the eraser. It was like kind of like a Willy Wonka kind of vibe. It was really magical. So yeah, it's like, I couldn't help but appreciate how amazing pencils are. And then I would go out on my book tour and do all some of the like funny stuff in the book, because the book gets kind of weird. But then at the end I would say, okay, now if you think this is a joke, ask me literally any question about pencils and I'll answer it.
And it was, where were they invented?
Well, how long is this podcast?
We can do an hour, you know, a 5-hour long pencil special.
The earliest known source of graphite was discovered in the 16th century in England, around the region in the west of England where there is a pencil factory. I think it's a pencil museum, the Cumberland Pencil Museum. Some shepherds had found an overturned huge deposit of graphite, and they realized they could use it to mark their sheep. They could identify their sheep by rubbing graphite on it. They called it plumbago, which is Latin for lead, which is why pencil lead has always been called lead, even though it's never been lead. It's graphite. It's a mix of graphite and clay, and that mixture of graphite and clay, the ratio determines the darkness or the softness of the pencil lead. So that's the difference between like a number 2 pencil and like a number 6 pencil or whatever, right? The more clay that's in the mixture, the finer the point and the more brittle the tip and the lighter the point. The softer pencils, the ones that artists use, you know, like it's like just, it gets closer and closer to being nothing but graphite. It's more expressive. It's a lot messier. You can smear it, you know, there's more opportunities for shading and stuff. So pencils overall started in, I guess you would say, the mid 16th century. And over the following hundreds of years, there have just been all these slight tweaks, you know, there's been, you know, changes to the chemical composition of the graphite mixture. And then there's been innovations in like the barrels, you know, hexagonal barrels versus circular barrels, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it goes back for hundreds of years.
Yeah. I had no idea. You're one of the best guests we've ever had on to talk about pencil history. Top 5.
Is this a pencil history podcast?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Surprise.
All right. So you have a podcast now called Election Profit Makers. You, I think, did the same thing in 2016.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the background of that podcast? And then we're going to want to ask some questions about what election forecasting is and what this industry that you're really covering is all about.
Sure. So Election Profit Makers, it's a podcast that I host with two friends of mine, John Kimball, who I grew up with in North Carolina and I've known since seventh grade, and then our other friend, Starley Kine. John John and I were talking in the summer of 2016. He always gets fixated on really interesting things. Like, he's really into infrastructure and skylines and ranking metro areas according to population density and building height and stuff. He used to have a tower of almanacs, and he would make videos about how amazing his tower of almanacs was. So he's kind of like a data nerd kind of guy. He had found this website called predictit.org, which is a website that has special dispensation to basically do online betting on political futures. They're allowed to do this because they are technically an academic research project about the wisdom of crowds in predicting political events. So the numbers that you see on Predictit are not polls of likely voters or anything like that. They are just people placing bets on what they think is going to happen. So every market on predictit.org is an event that either will or will not happen. They all resolve yes or no, okay? And you, anyone can invest. You can invest up to $850 in any market. And you use, like, actual money. You know, if you make money, they're going to send you a 1099 or something. You know, that hasn't been an issue for us, unfortunately, so far. But that could happen. So John, in the summer of 2016, realized that the Trump supporters who were on Predictit were so into Trump that they would boost Trump's chances, his market share, you know, on any Trump market. So John basically just started shorting Donald Trump all the time in all these different markets and was making a lot of money, because he was like, these people are so enthusiastic, they're not investing.
Rational. Made money because the outcome was a poll or what?
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of markets. Back then, it probably was like, will Donald Trump be the 2016 GOP nominee? Will Donald Trump's approval rating, you know, be such and so, be in this range? You know, there's multiple brackets for some of these markets. So he was just making money betting against these Trump voters. So I was like, oh, that sounds like it could be a fun podcast, you know. So we started doing it. I think we only did it for 17 episodes. We always said, we're going to end this the day after the election. It's just like my political cartoon career. Like, I kind of hate it. So it's like, as soon as this election is over, goodbye, we retire. But election night was so traumatic. John lost thousands of dollars because he had bet on Clinton winning the general election, and then there are all these state markets. He had bet that Clinton was going to win Wisconsin. He had bet that Clinton was going to win North Carolina, our home state. So he got completely wiped out. So when this election was gearing up again, we were like, let's get back into it and try to, like, recoup some of our losses, you know, try to get some of our money back. So we've started up the second season now.
How are you doing financially?
Well, I'm a little bit gun shy after 2016, so I haven't invested a whole heap lot of money. John is up. John made good money on the Bernie. There were a lot of markets about when Bernie Sanders was going to drop out. I was convinced Bernie Sanders would keep campaigning, like, through the election, like, would just never stop campaigning. But John made good money when Bernie dropped out, and I was surprised.
That's blood money.
When Bernie dropped out. Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, it raises a lot of ethical questions. And when you describe it, you do kind of come across as a sociopath.
It's more because I love Bernie. That's why I'm pretending it's blood money. But right. It makes sense the way you're saying it also.
Yeah. I mean, because betting money on things that do have real world life and death consequences feels a little ghoulish. So our standard disclaimer is, we are not sociopaths. We are using this weird financial instrument to talk about our mushy feelings about the state of the world. Do you know what I mean? It's like the lens through which we're actually talking about all this super heavy stuff.
Well, I mean, people get paid millions of dollars to make predictions that they have no idea, for which they have no basis. So why not?
And also for which they suffer no consequences, which is kind of the subtext of the podcast, which is that there's so many pundits who will go out and say whatever, and they can be colossally, like, I think about this all the time when it comes to the Iraq war. People like Thomas Friedman, you know.
And they fail up.
Yeah, exactly. At least for us, like, we do have skin in the game. Like, if we're wrong, we lose money. It totally happened on election night 2016. Do you know what I mean? So it's kind of a little, it's kind of a little joke about how for a lot of pundits, like, they get it wrong. Like, who fucking cares? They still get booked the next day on Morning Joe or whatever.
Yeah. Or they get gigs at MSNBC if they're Republicans. Yeah.
Right.
So you've got a, I think you got a trade on right now that I agree with too, which is that will Joe Biden be the nominee of the Democratic Party? And I don't know what the odds are there, but you're interested in no as a bet, right?
So the market that you're talking about is who will win the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination? And all the shares on Predictit go from 1 cent to 99 cents. And if it comes to pass, it pays out a dollar. So that's the numbers we're looking at. So in this market, Joe Biden currently trading at 86 cents, which makes, you know, stands to reason, right? But I bought no shares that he will not be the nominee. So I bought these, I can't remember, a few weeks ago, I bought no shares at 24 cents. So those are down 10. So I'm losing money on Joe Biden, but this is a long-term conservative investment that I've made here.
It's a Warren Buffett investment, right?
Yeah, this is not day trading. This is just like, we're just going to sit on this pile of nickels and just watch it grow and grow and grow until Joe Biden is not the nominee. And to be clear, this market does not have any language in it about who the other nominee, like who will replace him. It doesn't say he will lose at a contested convention. It's just yes, no. Will this guy be the nominee? If he wakes up tomorrow morning and trips on a necktie and falls and hits his head and goes into a coma and is not the nominee, then I get paid.
And he'll be not that different from how he is right now.
Right, which is kind of, I think, what made me get into this market. Watching that basement video of his, it was kind of like, I don't know if this guy has it in him, man. He's not, cards on the table, putting aside his history, putting aside his votes, putting aside the bankruptcy bill. I understand Joe Biden's appeal. I think back in the day, he was incredibly charismatic.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking ideology at all. When Joe Biden talks about America, like, come on, guys, this is America. Let's go get them. I like, as an American, I'm like, fuck yeah, man, I'm into it. Like, let's do it. Roll up our sleeves. Like,
Scrappy Joe.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I get that, you know, but the work he's had on his face,
I know,
and the basement videos, it was just like, this is not Joe Biden, man. I don't know if he's going to bring it home. Now, I haven't bet. Here are the other people who are in this, who are listed in this market. There are 32 other people that you can buy into. Andrew Cuomo is coming in on Biden's heels at 6 cents. Everyone got obsessed with Andrew Cuomo in contrast to the president. Then, you have Hillary Clinton at 4 cents because people always have strong opinions about Hillary Clinton, so they'll always dump their money into that market. Kamala Harris at 2. Bernie Sanders, you're not going to like this. 1 penny per share for Bernie.
Because he's a working man's candidate.
Oh, it's...
They can only afford one penny.
Wait, can you buy and sell these shares? In other words, like can you buy Cuomo when he's looking less likely, and then when there's a surge of publicity?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just like it's like the market. You can buy and sell whenever somebody matches your offer. So our co-host John Kimball is loves to ride these waves where, let's say, Andrew Cuomo has an amazing press conference or something, or has a charming banter with his husband. I mean, not with his husband.
With his brother. Slip. It's very, right. A lot of charge.
His brother husband.
Yeah.
Then his stock might shoot up, and then you could, let's say you bought Andrew Cuomo at 6 cents. Let's say you bought 500 shares of Andrew Cuomo at 6 cents. He has a great press conference. 2 hours later, he's trading at 12 cents. You can just sell your shares for 12 cents and be done with it. You know, you don't have to keep your position until the markets resolve.
Is Chris Cuomo on that list? Can you tell us who else is on that
list? When we go down to the bottom, we do some deep cuts down.
Who's at the bottom of the list?
Yeah, I want to know the bottom. Yeah.
You got Deval Patrick trading at 1 cent, just like Bernie.
Bernie and Deval are at the same one? Oh, my God.
Everyone's at 1 cent. You got Marianne Williamson, Jay Inslee, Tulsi Gabbard, Andrew Yang. Actually, I'm surprised Andrew Yang isn't a little bit higher
too,
given the nature of his supporters and the nature of the predicted culture. Beto O'Rourke, hanging tough, one penny. Michael Bloomberg. This is just Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah, who are the non-Pauls? Who are the non-Pauls?
You got Oprah Winfrey, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Oh, I might get into that.
Yeah.
My personal hero, Mark Zuckerberg.
Mm.
And nice. Then, so here's something interesting. One of the things that we talk about a lot on Election Profit Makers is, are we using predicted as an investment or as a wishing well?
Right, exactly. Right.
So I have shares in Elizabeth Warren being president just because she was my choice and I love her. I paid 4 cents a share back in the day after she had dropped out, but it was like, damn it, Liz. I'm still riding with Liz Warren. Let me put this intention out into the world and throw these pennies into this wishing well that Elizabeth Warren is going to be the president.
So the universe manifests it.
Yeah. It is kind of sober when you see that Elizabeth Warren's chances are the same as Dwayne The Rock Johnson's chances.
Yeah.
And Michael Bloomberg chances. But that's what's intense about predicted is it when the, and remember, these are not necessarily rational actors who are setting these prices and driving up share prices. But when you look at the fact that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are both at 1 cent and are below Hillary Clinton and Andrew Cuomo, it's just so sobering and kind of like, it can get pretty depressing.
Well, that's rational to me a little bit, because Cuomo is a more likely, and even frankly, Hillary Clinton is a more likely person to be put forward on a second ballot at the convention than either of those other folks, right?
Okay, and what about Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
Well, okay, no.
Toss up.
Yeah. Right.
I kind of think they're going to try with Warren. I know, Matt, you think that's stupid. I have this feeling they're going to try roast some progressive meat at the... All right.
What's going to happen?
I have this theory that they're going to nominate... If and when Biden sunsets permanently, that they're going to name Warren.
They'd name Jamie Dimon before they named Elizabeth Warren. There's just no way.
My theory, though, is that they'll name Warren because they want to placate the Bernie people. And
why would they want to placate that? They didn't placate the Bernie people during the race.
Dem exit?
Maybe. I don't know.
I'll bet a couple pennies on that. I'm not sure. But I'm just saying, I think it could happen.
And why do you think, Joe? So you guys are like me, right? On some level, you're like, I just don't see Joe Biden as the nominee.
Yeah.
So I tweeted after Super Tuesday. There were a whole bunch of people who were basically saying, like, okay, are you ready to say that Biden is the nominee? And I tweeted something to the effect of, there's a million scenarios that can happen between now and the convention. And people took that to understand that I still thought that Bernie Sanders was going to be the nominee or that he had a big chance. And that's not what I thought. I thought.
Yeah, right, right.
What I actually thought was just that there are lots of things that can happen between now and then, and other people are going to pop up and become the flavor of the moment. And Biden I just don't have a lot of confidence that he's going to be able to hang in there, like the same way as you, you know. Yeah.
But the ironic thing is, the coronavirus, although it's keeping him in his basement and making him look weak, you know, it's like when the economy crashed during the 2008 election, and then McCain suspended his campaign and went and gave that weird talk in that low ceiling green room. It looked like a hospital,
right,
morgue or something, and that kind of, for a lot of people, I felt, kind of doomed his campaign. Do you remember that? It was just like, this dude does not look like he's up to the job. So on the one hand, I think the coronavirus is putting Biden in that same situation. On the other hand, it's kind of the best thing for him, because he doesn't have to run around expending a bunch of energy doing rallies and, you know, like
forgetting what he's saying mid-sentence.
Yeah, just like he can be down in the basement and talk on his own terms, right, to whoever he wants to talk to. And I don't know. At the last debate, he seemed like he had a little more pep in him. So who knows? Maybe he's just saving up his energy for an intense old school Joe Biden ragegasm, you know, in the summer and fall before the election.
I think it could work against him, though, because I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but I still think it could work out depending on how many of the primaries get held. that he's going to go to the convention without 1,990 delegates, which means that they could put anybody on the second ballot.
And you, and your pick is Jamie Dimon.
No, it's not my pick. I'm just saying that, you know,
your prediction is before it would be Dimon before Warren.
Right, like, you know, God knows when Tom Perez and whoever else is actually running things at the and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer get together, who's going to be their choice to be on the second ballot? I just can think of lots of possibilities there. If Biden doesn't win it outright through votes, then all sorts of scenarios are in play, aren't they?
Can I nominate Chris Cuomo? Can I put him on the list if he's not there yet?
You can send an email to Predicted and request a market. Sometimes they take, they're like bands, you know, sometimes they take audience requests.
Yeah.
If you're fixated on Chris Cuomo.
Roger Stone. I'm just trying to think of people who would be.
If you want to get into Roger Stone, I think there used to be a Roger Stone market about his indictment.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's not just, the markets are not exclusively about politicians, but they do have to be politics adjacent. So there's a market like, will Rudy Giuliani be pardoned?
Right.
Of a felony by the end of the year, that type of stuff.
I like it. So for the general election, here's a question I have. I'm looking at the current situation, and it's Trump's at 49 cents, mm-hmm. and Biden's at 44 cents.
Right. So
there's an arbitrage there versus the polls, right? Like you could.
Oh, totally.
Right. Yeah. So this is what you were talking about last time. There's Trump people who are wish casting on these markets. Shouldn't you, I mean, it didn't work out well last time, but shouldn't you be able to make a big trade there and make some serious money?
There's arbitrage there, yes. And then there's also arbitrage in different markets that are worded slightly differently, because according to the regulations, Predicted, I think, can at any market at any given time, I think, can only have 5,000 shares. And so in addition to saying like, who will win the presidential election, you know, Donald Trump 54, Joe Biden 49, or whatever it is, there can be another one where the language is slightly different, but getting at the same thing. And a lot of times there's differences in the prices of those markets. And so if you're sure of, if you feel like you have an inside beat on objective reality, you can also make money that way. Hmm. But in terms of the current numbers, if Predicted was polling, if the Predicted numbers were like, you know, scientifically rational polling, then I think Biden would be a lot more worried than he probably is right now.
Can you have Predicteds on pundits? Like the market of whether Chris Cillizza will get it right, whether Harry Enten will get it right.
They don't do that because I think that is too far afield of politics and is kind of like outside their purview. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, I wish it was all current events, you know, that would be great. But for instance, like on a more serious note, if you go to Predicted and use the search function and search COVID, like they don't have markets on like the coronavirus death toll or something. Do you know what I mean? Probably for matters of taste, and also because it's too unknown. It's not their wheelhouse. Like not politics. And this thing is supposed to be about politics. So I don't think there's any Chris Cillizza markets, although I wouldn't mind shorting Chris Cillizza.
Yeah.
Although that's probably a bad bet. I mean, guys like that. This is the whole point of the thing, right? Guys like Chris Cillizza, they just keep going. It's like Energizer bunnies of bullshit, you know, and they just keep.
It almost seems like they're rewarded. The longer they are, the better they do.
Yeah, I wouldn't short any of those pundits except like maybe me. You know what I mean? Like that. Yeah. I wouldn't short Friedman or David Brooks or any, like,
Bill Kristol?
I think that's a long bet for me.
Those are blue chip stocks. You know, those are the blue chip stocks.
They're blue check stocks.
Oh, blue check, blue chip. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You could have a mutual fund.
What about?
It's like an index fund of the major.
Of shitty pundits.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the major, most famous pundits. Like, you know, that stock will just incrementally rise the years.
So
you know, like, then Brooks puts out a book about how we're losing our moral character and his stock goes up 1 cent, you know, that type of thing. Just slow and steady. That's how empires are built.
Right.
You know? He should put out a cookbook, David Brooks.
Yeah. Brooks Cooks.
A Guide to Sandwiches for the Working Class or something.
Oh, right. Because he took his friend to a deli and there was prosciutto and his friend had an aneurysm or something.
Yeah, exactly. She couldn't deal. Yeah. What about, do you guys see that Joe Biden has a podcast now? Now, that's a great thing for him to do because as we know, and Dan, our producer, knows full well, there's a lot of editing potential there.
Yeah, so, I wonder who's editing that podcast. I wonder how many copies of Pro Tools they burned through.
Yeah, I know. Seriously. I know, trying to like glide through, cut the words, the extra words or the offensive gaffes without making it obvious that you've made a cut. That's an art. There's an art to it.
Can I ask you guys a question about a market? Because I do have a position in this, because a couple weeks ago we interviewed my friend's son, who was a 12-year-old Biden bro.
Oh, I saw that.
He loves Joe Biden. So I asked this kid, Beckett, who should I invest in as Biden's vice presidential pick? And he gave me a name, not someone I'm particularly fond of, but I did put my money where his mouth was, and I invested in Amy Klobuchar at 23 cents, now trading at 27. So I've made a bit of a return on that. But Kamala Harris is the leader at 32. Is that who it's going to be?
I'd put my money. You know, that's a tough one. I might actually come around to your position on that one, David, because even though he's promised that his running mate was going to be a woman of color.
Warren, that's who it could be.
Wait, he didn't say a woman of color.
He said
the vice president would be a woman, and then I think he said he would appoint a woman of color to the Supreme Court. I think that's what it was.
I thought he suggested it would be a woman of color, but didn't promise, and then promised a woman of any background.
Oh, we're getting a woman. Yeah, we're so definitely getting a woman.
I mean, maybe a hint was that he called Klobuchar Globuchar the other day, which may be a sign that they're like, maybe he has a nickname for her, and that nickname is Globy. The result of their, of Globy, yeah. I think he should go with her only so she can open every rally with Donald Trump. I wonder how his hair would fare in a blizzard.
Is that a zinger that she has?
Klobuchar has this joke that she tells at basically every public appearance. And there's been a mashup done of all the different times that she's told this joke.
Right.
And
it's
like,
it's like having a
nail shoved under your fingernails. Basically, mm-hmm. It's terrible. I think it's going to be either Kamala or Klobuchar, but I can definitely see the internal thinking of the people in the Democratic Party drifting towards Klobuchar at the last minute.
Over Harris.
Yeah.
Stacey Abrams is trading at 9 cents. Oh, I'm a fan of Stacey Abrams, but I don't think she's
good. I like her because she tried to stay in the race. But if Biden and Kamala run together, they need to come in on separate buses. Like that has to be their arrival when they announce it.
So separate buses. Busing metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one has to get off, Joe Biden then has to invite Kamala Harris onto his bus, and then she gets on the bus and they're on the same bus together and they drive off and then they announce it or something.
Yeah.
Are they sitting side by side?
Yeah. No, she's sitting a seat ahead of him.
You think it's going to be Klobuchar? So Klobuchar is underpriced here then, because she's six. Actually, she just dropped a cent while we were talking.
Really?
I think the markets did not respond well to that supercut of Klobuchar talking about Donald Trump's
hair. It's so good.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris is 32 and Klobuchar is 26. Warren is 10. So here's an example of, and Gretchen Whitmer has dropped. That's an example of a wave. When the president was dissing Gretchen Whitmer, I'm sure that's the first time she probably popped up on this board as a vice presidential pick, because it makes sense, right? Michigan woman,
which makes me think wants her.
Yeah.
He wants her.
But now that's faded.
Yeah, but
and she's dropping.
Think about how people like, you go back to the last election. And how do you end up with Tim Kaine as the pick? And you just have to go through what's the thought process of people who would make that decision. And they're trapped in this old paradigm where it's, well, this person can deliver that state and signals to moderates and independents, blah, blah, blah.
Do you think that's still the logic that Biden's people and the party will be using, even in spite of everything that's happened?
They haven't learned from anything else.
They haven't learned from anything else. Yeah. So I think if they're looking at the regional issue, why would you pick someone from California? You're going to win California.
Yeah, right.
You know, and
that's an argument against Kamala Harris. It's like, we already have that state. What does she bring us? Right.
Right. also, you know, I mean, I could see them thinking, all right, well, we need to do better with black turnout than we did last time, because that was just, that right. was, but that's already a strength of Biden's, actually. So
that's why he won. I mean, that's why he won Super Tuesday, because right. South Carolina, right?
Right. So I could
Didn't endorse before, but after, and because the moderate consolidation, let's never forget, and the media. Sorry.
Yeah. So they're gonna say Klobuchar is somebody who's gonna appeal to independents and voters who are on the fence, and she has the regional balance that they're looking for.
What I liked about her was that I liked watching her attack Mayor Pete. That's when she had the most.
Wow, those two guys, put them on a bus together, watch the sparks fly.
Hey, David, as a comedian, which you also are, obviously. No?
Well, I haven't done stand-up in many, many years, but I didn't mean to derail you with my self-loathing. Go ahead.
Okay. If it turns out that way, is a Biden-Trump general election, is that funny or not? Is it funny or horrifying?
Can it be a tragicomedy?
I don't know. I think about this sometimes, you know, because I'm not a political cartoonist anymore. And obviously during the war on terror, there are a lot of horrible things happening that you had to make cartoons about. But I don't think...
Yeah, you made the invasion of Iraq extremely funny.
Well...
Even funnier than it already was.
There's something about the way... Maybe it's Twitter or how media works now. Like, the people I know who are still political cartoonists, I think are pretty ground down by the Trump administration. I think the noise of it and the chaos of it, you know, like, say what you will about George Bush and invading Iraq. There was a logic behind it. Do you know what I mean?
At least it was an ethos. Like,
yeah, exactly. Right. That's what I'm going for. Exactly.
There was an ideology behind it.
It wasn't, I mean, it was chaos because they did no planning and they had no understanding of the region. But the decision-making itself did not feel as noisy and chaotic right. as what comes out of
right.
the Trump White House. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, he was a neocon. He was governing.
Right.
Dick Cheney was governing through Bush as a neocon.
So it kind of made sense. And you were like, okay, I oppose this for blah, 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 blah. And that's the perspective of my cartoons. But like, I get it. Project for a New American Century, all that stuff. With Trump versus Biden, you know, I guess if you dig deep enough and look at the kind of tectonic things that undergird so much of American life, there's still logic to it, right? Rich people just want to make more money. White people hate black people, you know, like that stuff is still there. You just have to kind of like, you know, like disentangle all these vines of chaos that are like obscuring your view of what's still actually undergirding so much of our lives. But I think if I was still making political cartoons about Trump, I think the challenge is Trump is just such an obvious, horrific target. And he's just such a fucking bloviating fat orange idiot that of course that's going to be your first target. But after a while, it's kind of like he is uniquely like, I do think he's like one of the worst Americans of all time. Like just like near the bottom of any list of all Americans, not presidents, just all people. So he's an obvious target, but I think it must take a lot of work and a lot of discipline to be like, okay, but put him aside. Like, well, nobody cares about his hair in a blizzard. Like, that's not the thing, you know, and to dig a little deeper. This is a long-winded way of saying that I think if I was still doing political comedy, the Biden-Trump head-to-head, I think would just be enervating and just depressing. I mean, it's going to suck. I mean, this is going to be the death rattle of the baby boomers, like literally and figuratively. It's like two old baby boomers slurring and stumbling around each other because old people aren't willing to like let young people make decisions yet. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, I remember when Obama was elected, I was so excited because I was like, that's it. No more baby boomers running anything, you know? And then sure enough, they just couldn't let go. They brought back the most baby boomer dude of all time, Donald Trump, as a rejection of Obama.
Ellie Valley, who we had on earlier, the political cartoonist, Ellie Valley.
He does
a lot of stuff that's not, I mean, he's great. And I think part of the reason he's so great is because he doesn't just focus on Trump, which is
sure. Really, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
because he can turn into a lot of noise. And it's such low-hanging fruit. I do think that a Biden-Trump race would have its own dynamic that would be disturbing and also unintentionally hilarious. And I also think, I've said this before, but Trump is sometimes unintentionally hilarious himself. Like, not trying to be. And there's...
Sometimes he's even intentionally funny.
Kind of. Like, on a level where it's funny that he thinks he's being so funny.
Having a nuclear power, the leadership of a nuclear power with, like, the most money in the world, decided by two people who basically can't speak. Right.
Right. It's kind of funny.
But Trump is at least fluid.
He is fluid, yeah.
Well, it's... But
I mean, it's nonsense.
Fluid, but the river doesn't really make sense.
No, like, it's a total river of nonsense.
But you're just talking acoustically, like the waveforms are less halting than Joe Biden's waveforms.
Yes.
But listen, the thing I have to keep reminding myself, because I'm not super excited to vote for Joe Biden, but it's like, I'm not voting for Joe Biden, man. I'm voting for the deep state. Bring the deep state. Bring all the fucking scientists.
This is where Matt are going to disagree here.
Totally. Yeah. The coronavirus has turned me into the number one deep state fan of all time. Mm-hmm. People who work in shadowy rooms making charts and graphs and shit. Like, that's who I need back in the White House. I don't give a shit if Joe Biden is there. Like, who cares? The things I want are Stephen Miller out of the White House and then a bunch of nameless, faceless career scientists and politicians who will, like, just handle the shit. I'm not talking about deep state, like, oh, and then they're going to torture people in the CIA and black sites or anything. I'm not talking about that type of deep state. I'm talking about, like, the medical people who know what medicine is, like, that type of people who know the difference between a virus and a germ. Like, say what you will about Joe Biden, but his virus response, or Hillary Clinton for that matter, you think Hillary Clinton would have just sat on her hands and downplayed the they're like 20,000 people have died because of Donald Trump's personal decision-making style and his own vanity. That would not have happened if Hillary Clinton and all the centrists that we love to hate were in the White House. It just wouldn't have happened. Tens of thousands of people would still be alive.
That was actually earlier on we were talking about this. And for me, that's one of the main things that I think there's a big difference in, which is how to respond to a plague. I do think, though, we talked about this a lot, the way that the Biden campaign and the DNC pushed people to vote during Corona doesn't take away from what you're saying, but it was kind of like something I didn't think the Dems would do. And that
I'm going to disagree with you on that one, David. I think the response would have been basically identical. if you look back at the comments from the Democrats at the time, you know, that was barely an issue. It wasn't mentioned in any of the debates until...
Something being mentioned at a debate is different than somebody getting a briefing from some intelligence service being like, holy fuck, something's going on in Wuhan, China. We need to get ready.
Yeah, but there were Democrats who were at those intelligence briefings as well in Congress, and they didn't really... I think they would have handled it better. I do. But I don't know how much faster they would have done it. You know, I think
that, you know, like they're talking now about these lost 2 weeks, like where if they had done something 2 weeks earlier, like... Mm. Thousands of people. I would give them 2 weeks. I have that much faith in them. As you know,
that's actually a good metaphor. The difference between the Republicans and Democrats: 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Yeah. Right.
But this is what I'm saying, though.
I know it. It
there are some situations in which 2 weeks makes all the difference in the world. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It makes a huge fucking difference. I understand incrementalism is not exciting, but there are situations in which an incremental difference is actually a massive difference, especially when you're dealing with something on a logarithmic scale, right?
Or when the status quo is a lot better than, which is a very off-brand thing for me to say. I do think that when we're criticizing Biden, like in the way he speaks, it's not even because, okay, I don't like Biden, but I'm not saying this as a kind of a critique of Biden and his policies. I just think he's a terrible candidate. And so that's what scary. Yeah. And like, whether or not you and I and Matt, regardless of whether we think he's better than Trump, I do think he's uniquely vulnerable to Trump. And I'm really angry at Obama because I feel like the natural selection that could have happened didn't because of this intervention.
What do you mean?
Well, I think that without the moderate consolidation and without Obama talking to Bernie Sanders, And about without him talking to all the other people earlier on, I don't think Biden would be the nominee. And without the media refusing,
who would be the nominee?
I mean, I think it would have been Sanders. And that's not because I like him. Like, I think that, I mean, you could say that they would never have not intervened and it wouldn't have been Sanders. But if the media had been at all even-handed, and in, like Chris Cuomo said about Biden, this was his best debate ever. He was alert the entire time. That is something that should have been remarked on the entire time. And to be fair, I thought that there, at the beginning of this primary, I thought two people could defeat Donald Trump, Biden and Bernie. And I didn't, so my thinking someone's electable is not linked to my liking them, because I really don't like Biden, but I thought he was electable. And then as the election went on, I started to think he's not, because of the way he's, honestly, because of the way he speaks, doesn't finish sentences. And I think that the way he's been kind of like handled with kid gloves is going to just be terrible in the general, because he wasn't vetted the way he should have been, just behaviorally.
I agree with some of what you're saying, but Bernie Sanders lost on his own. He just did. I'm sorry. I mean, I like Bernie. I voted for him in 2016.
Yeah.
But his coalition, I think the point, we talked about this on our podcast, I think it is must have been incredibly poignant to Bernie to realize just how many of those 2016 votes he got were not votes for a revolution and were not votes against the Democratic Party establishment and politics as normal. They were votes against that bitch, Hillary Clinton.
I heard, yeah. I heard you say that. No, I heard you say that in your podcast.
He got a smaller share of the votes.
But wait, which ones are you talking about? Which primaries are four years?
The most popular politician in America. Incredible name recognition. And what happened? He got his ass kicked by Joe Biden.
Yeah, but this was after, I mean, okay. First of all, people were making that point when he was running against everyone, which is a ridiculous point. Like when his numbers went down, but he was winning. I mean, MSNBC, you're not saying this, but just as to me, an example of the entrenched media bias against him, which was so bad that you had a woman on MSNBC's town hall who was asked by Ari Melber who she was voting for. And she was not a radical woman, because she said that she thought there were a bunch of good candidates, including Elizabeth and Michael Bennett. And she voted for Bernie, she said, because MSNBC was so cynical in their treatment of Bernie, and she couldn't stand it, that she kind of voted for him out of spite. And she mentioned the fact that they kept pretending that he had gone down in popularity because his numbers went down between 2016 and now, even though he was running against multiple people versus just Hillary Clinton. But you're talking about it when it was just him and Biden? Is that what you mean?
I'm talking about South Carolina and Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with David here.
But how can we isolate it from the media stuff? I mean, Matt, your argument...
I think the media stuff is maybe true, but I think in the end, I mean, this is just my gut. This is my gut feeling.
Sure, that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if he's going to win the election, he's going to have to overcome it.
He's going to have to overcome that. Although right? I still think... Yes,
Donald Trump did.
Trump did, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because they gave him all this free media, and I understand what you're saying, whether or not it's like... Okay, the media was unfair, but he had to either overcome that or not. What I find frustrating is that I do think he would have done better in a general. I always thought he had a better chance to win the general than the primary. I get it. It's like you can't wish away the media bias. You can try to call it out and demonstrate it, but it's not going to disappear.
Look, it's a factor, but he had plenty of opportunities to win in spite of it and didn't. All right. Well, we don't have a whole lot of time, so David, for the general election, what's your plan? For a trade.
Are you asking me who I think is going to win the general election?
Yeah, basically. Well, no. I mean, I think it's a different thing.
I got to go with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I mean, everybody likes him. He's got good media, multiple hit movies.
Really good in Ballers.
Jumanji. Yep.
Also, he has a multiracial background, so he's very appealing to different ethnicities. And in a very interesting sign, the governor of Florida just declared WWE
essential service.
So if that's not a sign and that's not an opening, yep. I don't know what is.
That's incredible. You're right. Yeah. Exactly. No, I don't know. I mean, this is how we lost all our money in 2016, but I think any Democrat can beat Trump. And it's just a question of I don't know, just making sure the wheels don't fall off the wagon between now and November.
I think shorting Trump is a logical trade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's unpopular. The coronavirus is really bad. I don't think people will have forgotten about it by November. I think the economy is fucked. And I think he knows that, and his own vanity is what is going to drive his response. And I think it's just maybe going to make it worse. Not hoping for that, but I do think that if that comes to pass, he's going to be like pretty vulnerable. And I also think that the legendary voting bloc of suburban white women are just fucking sick of him and are sick of seeing his face. And so I think that works well for Democrats.
Wait, so they were soccer moms in 96. They were security moms in 2004. What are they now?
I don't know, just tired. Just tired moms, you know?
Retired and tired.
Retired, maybe, yeah. Maybe it's grandmas, you know? Or people who are locked at home with their kids, with their two kids, and have never had to deal with their kids for 24 hours because they're working professional women, and they're totally running on empty like so many of us are. And then they turn on the TV and they got fucking Donald Trump screaming in their face about disbanding the World Health Organization and not funding it. Yeah, it's like, they don't
What's wrong
give
with
me
that?
Sleep. They're like, give me Sleepy Joe. I'm sleepy. He's relatable. We're all tired. Like, I don't want a human Adderall pill as a president anymore.
Although we think he may have taken, but Sleepy Joe may have been on Adderall the last debate.
Yo, yeah. He was like the guy in Star Is Born smashing Adderall with the heel of his boot. But I like that, Joe Biden. Like, go ahead, Joe. Like, whatever gets you through the debate, you know? Yeah. Like,
seamless lying.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Anyway. So where can we find Election Profit Makers?
Election Profit Makers is on all major podcast platforms.
Excellent.
Does that sound like I know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. No, it does. Okay. It does.
It's funny. It's good. I liked it.
Oh, thank you.
David, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah,
and
thank you.
Good luck, and I hope you make lots of money.
It was great to see you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. David, we'll catch up.
All right. Okay, take care.
Take care. Yep.
Bye. Wow. I feel like I just got my war on.
You just got your war on.
We both did. We both had little disagreements. That's good, though.
We did, yeah. We should have more of those.
Yeah, mine was over the Bernie stuff, and yours was over deep state stuff. I was between you and David on deep state stuff, because I do think that, like, the expertise of the World Health Organization is important, but I also think that the CIA is bad. That's my
hot take. I'm not anti World Health Organization.
I guess they're not deep state, right? They're
I'm anti CIA and
me too. Okay, you're right. But I think he's referring to more of an expertise. I mean, I think, like, it's deep state and deep science.
Right. I did, but there's a whole, like, universe of people who spend who spent the last 15 years sitting in basements charting out exactly what they're going to do when a pandemic hits and all the amazing opportunities that's going to afford. I'm terrified of those people. I actually don't want them. I think they're going to have all sorts of, like, really fun ideas, like, you know, no more habeas corpus, and, you know, everybody wears their underwear on the outside. Right. So, you know, that kind of thing.
So that's deep state, deep science combined.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, but funny stuff. I'm going to go make some bets, but always fun to check in with David. If you're not familiar with his work, I strongly suggest you go check out Get Your War On and some other stuff that he's done in the past, How to Sharpen a Pencil. So we'll see you again next week, assuming that the world's still turning. And thanks for tuning into Useful Idiots.
Yeah, rate and review us. Find us wherever you find podcasts.
Buy merch. And you know what? I'm beginning to get back into the old, you know.
Thank you.
No, don't listen to Pod Save America. Yeah.
Do not listen to it, whatever you do. Now more than ever.
All right. On that note, we'll see you next week.
All right.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.